word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Only a few days after international weapons inspectors arrived in Syria, they've begun destroying its stockpile of chemical weapons, along with the equipment used to make it. The program to eliminate President Bashar al-Assad's chemical weapons program within 9 months began last week. It was prompted by a UN Security Council resolution made after discovery of a chemical weapons attack on civilians in the outskirts of Damascus in August. The team is working in an active war zone, reportedly using blowtorches and heavy trucks to crush weaponry. For a sense of what weapons inspectors do, we spoke to Tim Trevann before the destruction began. He worked as UN weapons inspector in Iraq in the early 1990s and is currently executive director of the International Council for the Life Sciences. As a person who's built inspection teams, I asked him what kind of expertise he would want on the ground for a sensitive mission.
There are different types of inspections depending on what you're trying to do. Obviously, in terms of discovery, you can either be trying to find a facility where illegal activities are taking place, and then you want to combine people who can look at aerial surveillance, whether it's from satellites or aircraft photography, with an approach on the ground to identify particular buildings and then go in and question people about the specifics of what's going on. So if it's a production facility, you will need people who can do that aerial surveillance and interpretation combined with industrial chemists and industrial engineers who will be able to recognize the equipment for what it can do and the chemists who will be able to tell you what chemicals could be produced from that.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of discovery of production facilities, that's what you would need. In terms of discovery of weapons, you would need munitions experts who could tell you what types of fill could be inside the munitions. You need people who know how to use safety equipment, chemical agent monitors to tell you whether there's agent around you, people who can tell you how to put on your personal safety equipment, like the suits and the respirators. And if you're going into a place that has been bombed, you'd certainly want structural engineers to tell you whether the buildings are safe to enter and explosive ordnance personnel to be able to tell you whether there's unexploded bombs around you. So you want to make your team according to where you're going and what you're doing.
You wrote a book about your experiences in Iraq called Saddam's Secrets. You didn't get a lot of cooperation in your target country, which I'm guessing must be the case. Did you get a sense for when you're being told the truth or when you're being lied to?
Oh, absolutely. The fact of the matter is it's very easy to maintain a simple lie, but it's very difficult to maintain a complex lie, particularly when it's across a number of people. So you very quickly, if you ask a question, well, what happened here? And they tell you something and you say, well, what did you do? And then they can't give you a consistent story of what they and their work colleagues all worked on and what they produced over the course of 10 years or so. Then you get the sense that the story is a lie.
I remember reading a couple of pages of accounts in your book, Saddam's Secrets, of, you know, office buildings with file cabinets suddenly overturned, furniture moved around. I guess sometimes destroying the evidence is a little more clear.
Yes, it can be as simple as a document that is supposed to be 10 years old or 15 years old, clearly being on very fresh paper with fresh ink, or it can be dirt lines on the wall where furniture has recently been moved to hide something or to remove something. Or it can be a dust cloud on the horizon as you see trucks moving away across the desert when they shouldn't be leaving the facility that you're trying to inspect.
Once the evidence is gathered, how are you then tasked with handling it?
If the country you're inspecting is trying to hide things from you, the key thing is to put their story into a position where it no longer is credible. And then it's really on to them to come up with a credible story, or for you to go to the Security Council and say, well, this is our clear interpretation of the story and its failure to stand up to scrutiny. It's up to you, the Security Council, now to put pressure on the country to come clean. If they get cooperation, then they could go ahead and do the destruction and all that. If they can't, then they have to report that back to the Security Council for their decision of how to proceed.
We'll get to destruction in just a moment, but I'm curious about this part. The UN team that was in Syria, for example, after the August attack, came out with a report but did not accuse the Syrian government outright of using sarin gas or other chemical weapons against its citizenry. There are a lot of diplomatic protocols that have to be observed here. I'd love to hear you characterize how your work on the ground changes because of that, or does your work not change? It's just how you talk about it changes.
Well, it's certainly the art of the possible. And if you look back to the political circumstance, particularly in relation to the Syrian situation, there was an impasse in the Security Council. The logjam was broken when a specific deal was agreed between the Russians and the Americans. And part of that specific deal was that the inspectors would only be looking for the technical fact of whether chemicals are being used or not, and if so, what, rather than to ascertain blame or apportion blame. That said, through the technical nature of their report and the way they reported, it would take a very blind person or somebody willfully blind like Lavrov to see that that report didn't actually apportion blame to the Syrian authorities.
Going into an inspection is a very dangerous business. Do you assume that you will be under attack, and how do you protect yourself against it?
Well, actually, the assumption is precisely the opposite. The assumption is that it is the job of the host nation to provide for your safety and security. It is an inherently dangerous job without there being a civil war and without there being personal attacks on the inspectors. You're going in to a facility where there are highly toxic chemicals. That's the whole point of the facility. And these toxic chemicals are delivered by means of either rocket propellant or high explosives. It is a tense job. We certainly were exposed to threats on our lives through telephone calls during the middle of the night. On one particular inspection, they were about hourly throughout the night for pretty much all of our inspectors. So those things happen, but you just have to brace yourself to think that this is just intimidation, while being constantly aware that it could escalate to worse.
One of the big distinctions, of course, with the team that is in Syria now is about dismantling a chemical weapons stockpile. How do you identify and then contain them?
So the basic way it worked is that we agreed with the Iraqis the procedure, and then we supervised them doing it. The Iraqis gave us a declaration about their holdings of equipment, of precursor chemicals, and of bulk agent and field munitions. And then we came up with a plan for their destruction. For the larger stockpiles of precursor chemicals and agent, we were able to reverse engineer their existing production facility into a destruction facility. So we used the reactor vessel that had been used to make the chemical weapons to hydrolyze the agents and to destroy a lot of the precursor chemicals. Mm. For the destruction of the munitions, some of them were in very dangerous conditions. Some we were able to empty and destroy in the same way as the bulk chemicals, but others which were too dangerous to open, we actually destroyed through explosive incineration. We dug pits into which the munitions were then placed, along with aviation fuel, and a small charge was used to open up the munitions to expose the agent at the same time as a fireball was created to incinerate anything which was released.
Wow, that must have been an incredible scene.
Yes, it was visually impressive.
So how would the situation in Syria be different, do you imagine?
Well, for this first stage, I can imagine that it will be pretty much the same. The inspectors will go in, they'll identify the equipment and the empty munitions to be destroyed. Then they will tell the Syrians how it should be destroyed, what will be satisfactory to the inspectors in terms of destruction. So obviously, if you've got a motherboard which controls a chemical reaction, if you simply take a hammer to that and break it up, that will be okay. If you have munitions which are a certain shape and you drive a tank or a steamroller over them and crushes them, that will be considered pretty much adequate destruction of those. Drilling holes in reactor vessels or welding them shut so they can't be opened, that's the sort of thing I would imagine would happen in Syria. And then you get to the question of the destruction of the precursor chemicals and the bulk agent.
Often I talk to people and realize that the reality of their job, we only get a very small slice of it from the outside. You know, chemical weapons inspectors, we see pictures of people in hazmat suits going through wreckage and through buildings. But the reality is that it's often a very sort of bureaucratic, slow-moving job, something I think is reflected in your book, Saddam's Secrets. How much time did you actually spend on the ground in countries?
Personally, I spent very little time there because I was more on the strategy and the communication policy side. But even for our inspectors who went in on the hunt side, looking for weapons and looking for production capabilities, they probably spent less than a quarter of their time in the country, maybe even less than that, maybe more towards a tenth of the time in country, because the bulk of the effort of hunting down weapons is in a very careful analysis of the data that's available. It's in hunting down other sources of data, whether they're the actual suppliers in the first place of the raw materials or the equipment, or it's looking at the satellite or aerial imagery, trying to piece everything together, trying to get a view of what the whole program looked like from its inception to the current day. So it is a very analytical job for the most part.
Tim Trevann, thank you so much for sharing some of your time with us today.
My pleasure.
That's Tim Trevann. He worked as a UN weapons inspector in Iraq in the early 1990s and wrote a book about the experience. It's called Saddam's Secrets. We spoke with Tim just after a UN weapons inspection team arrived in Syria. They've since begun destroying some of President Bashar al-Assad's arsenal of chemical weapons, along with the machinery used to produce it. You'll find more on Tim's work and the inspector's progress at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, we're going to explore a uniquely human emotion, disgust, and its connection to lust, anger, and societal expectations. That's when Word of Mouth continues.